Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers Podcast. I'm David, and my guest this week is Wilf Nelson. Wilf is a psychologist turned neuroscientist who studies inhibitory and regulatory mechanics inside the brain. And if you have no idea what that means, that's okay, because neither did I. But think of it this way. If you listen to this podcast in a relaxed state, say with your eyes closed, that part of your brain that processes auditory information lights up, but that part that processes visual information, not so much. It doesn't mean that you go blind suddenly. You know, that never happens. Your brain is not processing as much visual information as if it was focused on that task. And what Wilf does is he studies that process and how it happens. Wilf's interview was recorded in two sessions. In our first session, we talk about the science that he does and what it all means. And he clears up some of the myths of neuroscience or the misconceptions that people may have had. And in the second session, we talk about his science communication and the podcast that he hosts, What a Cooler Neuroscience. Okay, hello Wilf, how are you doing?
I am fine, thank you. It is actually warm and sunny here in England, which is like once in a year we get this.
Wow, it's actually kind of cool here in California, which is kind of odd for this time of year because we're actually getting hot now. So I don't know, maybe it has something to do with everyone staying indoors and climate change or something.
I have heard that the weather patterns have changed because of people traveling. I don't know how that links to climate change. To be fair, though, I do a PhD in neuroscience, and that makes me feel like I probably shouldn't make claims about the climate.
Oh, well, I don't know. It's psychology, I guess. Well, no, that's not neuroscience either.
I am a psychologist and a neuroscientist, to be fair. We can go into this, but I trained in both, and they are different.
Okay, well, why don't we start by telling the listeners something about yourself? Like, what do you do? And so, what's your background?
Yeah. So my undergraduate degree, which I have an undergraduate degree, is in a BSc, a Bachelor's of Science in Psychology, and I am an accredited British Psychological Society psychologist. That means that my course had certain things I had to learn, and I had to be able to do experiments, I had to learn statistics, I had to learn about 12 fundamental different fields of psychology, and I graduated and became a psychologist. Then I did a couple of other things, and eventually I got bored and came back to research and academia and trained instead to be a neuroscientist, which is different. Psychologists are interested in the mind, what you're thinking about, how your brain does different things. A neuroscientist is a lot more interested in the organ, the actual biological matter of how your brain is handling stuff. Psychology can approach things that neuroscience can't sometimes. So, for example, the abstract sense of hope. That's been discussed a lot in psychology, and when people are hopeful and hopeless in different situations, neuroscience is not particularly comfortable discussing that topic because it's a very complex thing to watch how different parts of the brain as an organ create such a dynamic and rich experience like hope. And when we look at the brain through an imaging machine, there's just too much there. We don't know how to pick it apart. So neuroscience answers other more fundamental questions about how the brain works. And they're kind of complementary. It's really quite hard to gel the two together sometimes. Because, to be fair, lots of neuroscientists also aren't psychologists like I am.
So how do you manage to like use your training as a psychologist and use it to complement your training as a neuroscientist?
At the moment, I don't actually very much. Only very recently has my training as a psychologist been relevant. So I guess we can explain what I do. I do a PhD. I am near the end of my PhD. And my PhD is in something called inhibitory and regulatory mechanics. What this means is your brain, okay, first things first, your brain does not use 10% of it. Your brain uses all of your brain all the time. Your brain is constantly active. About 25% of any calories you intake will go to your brain because your brain is that hungry for energy.
Wow.
It's really, really hungry for energy, and it just absorbs oxygen too. That's literally why we have fMRI. You might have seen it on movies where you go into this bore and they get an image of your brain. The only reason we can tell what's going on is because your brain is so hungry for oxygen And when you see these places light up in the brain, that's because of oxygen. Now, why it matters is your brain actually tries to be a bit clever, and it realizes, say that you're listening to a podcast, where you could listen to this podcast lying in bed with your eyes closed. Your vision isn't actually helping with the quote-unquote task. And neuroscientists love to talk in tasks. So the task when you're listening to this podcast is to listen to the podcast. Your vision doesn't matter. So what if we could dampen or kind of put into a slow gear your visual system? And that's what happens. I've done scans, got people to do tasks and seen their brain, and their visual system's super active when we get them to listen to sounds in the scanner. When we look at their visual system that wasn't relevant, it was dampened. Now, that doesn't mean they go blind. It doesn't mean they see worse or anything like that, but there isn't as much information. And if we were to suddenly flash up something in their visual system, they might be slightly worse at perceiving what it was, slightly worse at remembering the fine details. Their reaction time might be slowed by a few percentage points. So there is an effect, but it's not me saying you go blind when you listen, because that's clearly absurd. To answer your question, though, about how the psychology in me came in, I promised that in about 20 minutes of explaining, we'll get to how I kind of got interested in more complex ways we can look at how the brain handles that system of turning things on and off. And the psychologist in me was prepared to handle those really complex systems.
Oh, I see. So let me see if I'm getting this straight. So basically, the brain can sort of like allocate power to the various parts of itself that it needs to. So if it needs to listen, it can focus on that. That part of the brain will become more active, and it can dampen the visual part of the brain if it needs visual part of itself if it needs to. Is that correct?
Yes, but don't think of when you say the brain does it. We don't know how to actually conceptualize that sentence or phrase it properly. We don't know if there's one central region that handles where power is distributed, what region decides what gets turned on and off, or if it's each region is capable of doing this to each other and effectively it's a free-for-all.
Yeah.
The answer, as with most things in the brain, is probably half of one and six dozen of another. I completely butchered that phrase. Wow. But the general principle is there. We just don't know if there's a little man in your head pulling switches that decides, or if it's a very free-flowing, organic process.
Okay. Well, that was my really bad phrasing, and that just completely blew my mind away.
No. People say it this way all the time. Even neuroscientists say the brain turns things on and off here, and it's completely wrong, but we just don't have a better system to really put down what are the players, what are the relevant systems, how do we even understand those systems? Because at a certain level, your brain doesn't work like a person. It works like many organic systems interacting with each other. And the output of that can be a person who is conscious and thinking. But when you get to the real guts of the system, the subconscious basic processing, it's really hard to find any analogy that works.
Well, that's good. At least so I'm not the one like totally making a mess of your field by butchering something and you're thinking, oh my God, this guy's an idiot.
No, that's my job. No, I'll butcher my field. It's okay.
So as far as your research is concerned, what I know you sort of like touched on it, but how about we go a little bit more in depth into what exactly you're studying right now?
So I've done two studies.
Yeah.
Which have been to conferences around the world. I got to present a couple across the UK. I got to go to Rome. I'll explain what those are, and then I'll explain the concepts of the ones that we're currently working on, but we are literally in the process of analysing the data. So I can't say what we found because I don't know yet. But I can at least explain the thinking about how we want to progress and try and move the research that we're doing.
Okay.
Best way to do this is to wind back to my master's. So when I applied for my master's, to do a brain imaging master's, you have to do a project. You have to do a full, it can be 12, it can be 6 months, time spent in a real neuroimaging lab, collecting data, processing it. You are effectively a research assistant. I actually applied for a whole bunch of them. You have to apply for 10. And I got given one that I'd kind of put on there generally. I apologize, but my supervisor, if he ever listens to this, knows that Actually, I applied to him for one I wanted more. There was more than one in his lab, and I still didn't get the one I asked for first. So he already knows this. What it was about was regulatory mechanics, about how the brain regulates and turns areas off and turns areas on. First thing he did was he gave me this paper that was actually written by the bloke who taught me memory in my undergrad, and it was called the Alpha Inhibition Hypothesis. The Alpha Inhibition Hypothesis is actually based on something called the alpha waves in your brain. Alpha waves are about 9 to 13 hertz, easily identifiable in that range. And they appear for the last 100 years or so that they effectively were there when you were resting. So you weren't asleep, but you were chilling out. And when the first ever experiments with EEG, where they put the cap on your brain and they get the wiggly lines on the piece of paper, or the wiggly lines on the computer nowadays, noticed that when the participant wasn't really doing anything, they saw these alpha waves. It's a nice regular rhythm that the brain goes into when it's just relaxing, daydreaming too. So I got given this paper and I got told to read. And what this paper told me was, we can be more inventive with this signal. It turns out that, as I've already kind of spoiled, areas that aren't relevant to the task we're doing will show an increase in alpha. They'll almost be forced to rest. And if we then switch that around and I make you look at something but you don't need to hear it, or I make you hear something you don't need to look at it, the entire system flips in a couple of seconds, and suddenly what was being made to rest or being inhibited is suddenly the thing that's active, and the thing that you were using, like your ears to listen to a podcast, are now being inhibited. They're being forced into this pseudo-resting state. Now, nobody actually knows if it is forced rest, because it's still true. You can rest and you'll see alpha waves. We don't know if this state, when you're doing a task and a reading that's not relevant, goes into alpha. Is that forced rest? Is that actually a type of inhibition? These are things we just don't know again. These are effectively semantic wordplay discussions that we need to have in the field so we can be really clear. But for the rest of this podcast, I won't go into it because it just gets confusing and there aren't answers at the moment. So my supervisor set me up and said, first thing we're going to do is we're going to do EEG, which is where you have that shower cap on your head with all the cables and you get bunch of gel put in your hair so your brain can have its signals come through your skull up to the sensors and we can try and read what your brain waves are doing. So sharp-eared listeners might have noticed there's two ways to measure inhibition and regulation. I mentioned way at the beginning of the episode about oxygen. EEG has nothing to do with oxygen. It doesn't really even know oxygen exists. It cares about electrical signals. And fMRI does care about oxygen. You can actually measure this inhibition, this regulatory effect, through both ways. So EEG, it's almost impossible to hurt somebody with it. fMRIs are very dangerous machines, and you have to go for a lot of training. So logically, in my master's, I did the safe one first. We did a whole bunch of data analysis, we collected a whole bunch of people, and effectively what they had to do was look at a screen that had a checkerboard. Checkerboards are great for exciting the visual system. They're flashy, they turn on and off, where black was once black is now white again. If you make them flicker, they take up big parts of the visual field. They're really excellent things to make the whole visual field active. We put some beeps in somebody's ears, far less pleasant than what you're listening to now, I promise you, and I still hear them in my sleep because I heard them so many times. And then we made people's thumb twitch. So you can get a stimulator, you can put it on somebody's thumb, and it will make them twitch. It's less painful than like grabbing an electric fence or something that I did as a kid being an idiot. But it's a very similar sensation. It's that very artificial tense of a muscle. And we made them do these tasks. And we know from a bunch of research that whatever we turn on, other places will turn off. So why was I doing research in it? Okay. Thank you, listener, for thinking that. Well, the reason is nobody had actually bothered until then to try and do more than one sense at once. Which seems bloody obvious, but nobody had done it. And sometimes research can take a while. If you think about it, this theory, this alpha inhibition hypothesis that I was handed as a paper came out in 2013. I started my master's in 2016. So there'd only been 3 years and I was already kind of joining in on a study that had been working. So this was as cutting edge as it gets. And what we did was we went, okay, so I can show you something visual and I can play the auditory. Why don't I just do them together? Because we've still got some areas that we know aren't relevant to that. So we always have to make sure when we're doing this field of regulation and inhibition, something isn't relevant. Well, I'm kind of lying there, but you'll see by the end why I'm lying. And what we did was we did visual and auditory and your thumb twitching, etc. And we kind of did every possible version. Then, when I'd started my PhD, because I effectively rocked up to my supervisor's office and went, can I have a PhD? To which I thought I was going to get told, go away, no. And he just said, yeah, sure, that works. Which was a crazily blunt conversation to have. We started fMRI. And we wanted to look at, could we understand this process better if we looked at how the use of oxygen and blood flow around the brain was being handled? EEG, due to reasons that I can't really go into here without doing a 40-minute lecture on EEG, really struggles to see deep down in your brain. But fMRI can do that really well. So what we did was we accepted that we were going to see things on a lot slower timescale. We accepted that we weren't going to see real electrical brain waves. We were going to see the product of them. So when your brain fires, it needs oxygen. So we are seeing the result of your brain firing. We see this oxygen requirement. And we moved to the fMRI. And I started to learn how to use that system through supervision, and eventually I did my own training courses, but no more about that. And we did the exact same thing. Part of science is to be replicable, to be able to test the same mechanism and probe it in different ways and understand it. Then the results got hilarious. So the EEG didn't behave at all, and we know that the participants were being stimulated. However, the auditory stimulation was very weak and didn't do anything. You can't actually measure the auditory system with EEG very easily, so we had to measure the results of it, and unfortunately it was just not strong enough. Stimulating the thumb was really powerful. We saw very strong effects there. However, again, it wasn't strong enough to cause other regions of the brain to activate in the way we wanted, and our theory that the more senses that we added, the more the regions that weren't relevant would show even more inhibition, they'd be even more turned off, quote-unquote, just didn't pan out. Then we did fMRI, and we actually saw that everything worked. So we're still trying to figure out why the EEG version didn't work and the fMRI did work, but we suspect it's due to the different ways in which the brain was handling the same, we're looking effectively at the same mechanism, probably, in two different ways. And what we were looking at, one was just more equipped to show us what we wanted. The fMRI turned out some really interesting results. And what we learned was that, basic bit of neuroscience for you, if you were to stimulate your visual system with a flashing checkerboard, say, you know, it's half brightness or some, it's half contrast, your brain will activate a certain level. And if you double that contrast, you double the brightness, it will actually almost double the neural response. And eventually you'll hit a level which you're overloaded and your neural response can't go any further than that. We kind of expected inhibition signals to work the same way, that the more you needed to inhibit regions, the more they inhibit. It doesn't work like that, and we're very confident saying this now. What we have found is that your positive systems, the systems that activate, will increase in their requirement for oxygen and their requirement of neural signals the more you stimulate them. Inhibition, a region that's not needed because you're stimulating something, effectively has an on-off switch. It will be inhibited or it won't, and it doesn't really matter how much extra you add.
Oh.
They just stay off.
Sounds cool.
So that was the first few studies I did. And kind of a great lesson in, just because you are looking at one thing in one way and then you come to it in another way and you assume you're looking at the same mechanic, doesn't mean that the results are always going to be the same way. I actually took a poster to the European, it's called ESRC, it's Economics and Social Science, which psychology is on occasion classified as a social science research council. And I did a there was a conference, I took a poster, and I effectively presented these two studies to say, you can't just say that you're doing neuroscience and claim that you have a result, because here's the exact same study done with two different methods and they show completely different things. So you can't just tack neuroscience onto these social science studies. I got interesting receptions to that idea.
So what is people's reaction when you said, oh, well, just because you're doing social science, you can't make that neuroscience, and I guess vice versa?
So, yeah, to be really clear, what I was saying was not you can't do social science and do neuroscience. What I was saying is you can't do a social science, be a social scientist and not be trained in what these machines are doing, because the outputs of the machines are so complicated. As we did with the exact same experiment two times, you can see really different things. So if you're not trained as a social scientist to understand how an EEG or an fMRI are giving you results, you could get very confused and make false assumptions. And I took that. It was kind of, you think about it, I shouldn't really have had to. It was bloody obvious, but I did. And I got told by a couple of people to leave. I literally got asked to my face why I was there and why I'd even bothered. To be fair, the person next to me then defended me and told them to shut up because they were amazed anybody was so rude. But there was a mixed response. Some people didn't want to hear that effectively they needed to go for more training because they were flaunting that they didn't need to understand the machines.
Oh.
But it takes a long time to become a neuroscientist. I'm still not technically there. So it was only a cautionary measure. And I didn't actually go to that conference in particular because I wanted to pick on anybody. I just went because it was a big conference and I wanted to present this concept to particularly highlight the complexities of understanding electrophysiological data or your blood oxygen the blood oxygen data you can get from the brain and how they're different, and just some very strong responses. Fun though, weirdly fun. Awkward as well. When I actually went to Rome and presented the fMRI paper, because that one we understood a lot better, we just got quite a few people who were very interested, because to kind of give a bit more detail, the important part of it was that we found if you were to take the visual system being active as your like litmus test, your standard, we present you a checkerboard, we know what's going to happen, it's been done for ages. What we see is that the auditory system is so weak at inhibiting, it basically doesn't count almost. It can inhibit, but it's much, much weaker. But if we add the motor systems and your, what we call them, the somatosensory systems, but effectively it's your awareness of your skin in your body, that's much stronger at inhibiting. So the real message we took to Rome was, if you're telling me you activated something and you're inhibiting something, I need to know what those systems were, because they all work uniquely, they all work in different ways, and we just need a bit more clarity. And scientific communities are usually very receptive to that discussion.
That's good.
Yeah, it was great. I got to meet some really cool people, and I had literally some guy going, I didn't think anybody else in the world studied this, which was a great conversation.
So from my understanding that as a neuroscientist, you only study one particular part of the brain.
No, I don't.
So the brain is made up of like several sections, right? And I guess you can say what some people describe as like, say, the reptilian brain, and on top of that are several other things. So all that activity that you're studying, is it just in that gray matter, or is it everywhere?
Okay, so I'll unpack this a bit. All brain activity is in your gray matter. Your gray matter is the thinking neuron bodies.
Right.
So, you know, on occasion when you see in the movies and they zoom into somebody's head and you see all these neurons firing, those cell bodies, the things that flash, that's your gray matter. And it's in big fans. You can actually type in on Google right now if you're on your phone listening to this. Gray matter, white matter. The white matter is the tracks. It's the things that send the information, the wires that come out of the cell bodies. So when we're talking about this, the gray matter is the thing that's making the signals, the thing that's being inhibitive, it's not needed. The white matter is the thing sending the information to those different places. As for the reptilian and the other parts of the brain, I don't massively subscribe to it. There is some evidence for it. We know that the things like our brainstem we do share with reptiles. The higher up regions we share with other more advanced mammals like dolphins and certain types of apes and chimps. But really, this spans across the entire brain. We can see there's something called the default mode network, which is this network in the brain that handles a lot of things. It's a real, by neuroscience standards, it's a very complex system. It can involve almost anything that requires internal reflection, daydreaming, all of those random thoughts. You'd call it the super high parts of your brain. But as soon as we do these tasks, it always deactivates because it's a what's called a non-task correlated region, meaning if you are doing something, the default mode network is off. Quick and simple way to remember. So you can have a look and say like, oh, well, the reptilian brain is interacting with the reptilian brain. It's not that case. We quickly leave that behind. It's not helpful enough for us. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of makes sense.
So, and as for the brain has seven regions, could you clarify a bit more? Because I think I know what you mean, but there are so many ways to segment the brain.
Well, I was just thinking, okay, at least the way I was taught about the brain is that as we evolved, certain things, you know, the certain parts of the brain evolve first. So we have like the spinal cord, right? Which is probably like one of the more basic parts of it, right? That evolved, that cord. And then other structures kind of like started being built on top of it until we eventually evolved to that big chunk of gray matter that we have. So I was just wondering if when you look at brain activity, are you just looking at what happens in the gray matter, or is it everything?
Okay, so I've already talked about the grey matter, white matter distinction. Right. That's effectively down to the cell type, but so the simplest way you can cut up the brain is with what's called the lobes.
Yeah.
There are the occipital, the parietal, the temporal, and the frontal lobes. And then obviously you've got a whole bunch of other regions like the brainstem. We pretty much use all of those. Let's get a bit more complicated. Next thing you can do is something called Brodmann's area. So Brodmann was a Victorian era scientist, and he separated the brain literally by cutting up the brains of dead people. And anytime he was moving across the surface of the brain or inside the brain and he noticed there was a change in the cell types of the brain, he labeled it must be a new area, thinking, well, if the cell types are changing, it must be a different function. It must be doing something new. Not a bad idea. It was a little bit simple. Even then, we still will go across a couple of dozen Brodmann's areas, and there are hundreds of Brodmann's. There's about 100 Brodmann areas altogether. I have a brain right here somewhere that's labeled with them. So we're still using a massive chunk of the brain. You go even more into being advanced. The occipital regions are made up of billions of neurons, all with different functions. Some can see lines, some activate better on different angles, some activate better on conflicts of information, some see movement, some see color, some see color changes and consistency. We're still using those. So one of the nice things about even just doing fundamental neuroscience like I do, you still get at the brain in its very complicated, billions upon billions of neurons all communicating with each other kind of way. There is no simple version of being able to cut up and go, this part of the brain does this, this part of the brain does that. It just doesn't work that way, unfortunately. It makes our lives a lot simpler, but it doesn't work that way.
Okay.
And this has no effect on evolutionary psychology. I joke regularly that squirrels probably show the same system we do. So this is a very early part of neural mechanics.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess maybe I was just reading the wrong books or reading watching the wrong YouTube videos.
Neuroscience is complicated. You tend to need to really find a trained PhD neuroscientist to be able to get through some of the myths are just really confusing, and it takes a long time when you train as a neuroscientist, I remember, to have them drilled out of you. It took me years to get rid of some of them.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can be just on a video and somebody's confused, and it's no fault. It's a really complicated topic.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to you, I feel like I need to get a PhD just to like fully understand everything. I mean, I understand what you said. It's just like to really, really understand it, I think I'll have to spend the next couple of years just studying it. But it is fascinating.
Well, I'm glad to hear. So I guess I'll talk about the other two things that we do afterwards, which we are currently analysing. So I'll talk about the concepts that we wanted to look at, but I can't, unfortunately for the listeners, tell them what we found, because we don't know. It's that simple. So the basic concept was what happens if we look at increasing the sensory load to be closer to everyday life, or we start to have multiple competing lines of information. So your visual and your auditory system are both competing. How do non-relevant regions handle that? Now, bit of neuroscience for everybody, which you won't know, and don't feel that I'm saying anything about that, is when you're going for these experiments, say that you're about to do a visual trial, I'm going to put up a big cue, not literally the letter, but something to cue you that this is coming up. And there's a reason for that, which is the brain's a bit sluggish. It takes normally about half a second to a second to do what we want it to do. So rather than have you go, oh, look, it's visual, I'll kind of respond now and manage. That's not what we want. We're going to get a whole bunch of dead data, and the data is really expensive to collect. So we give you a warning, and then the brain gets into the state it wants to get in. And by the time we present the stimuli, normally about a second later, your brain is performing pristine and in a nice, clean, reactable way that we understand is the best way to put it. It's still very noisy. It's still doing a lot of complicated things, but it's doing what we expect it to do, and it's had a chance to catch up. But again, that's nowhere near real life. You don't get warnings that something is going to be distracting you. And even if you did, you wouldn't know the warning's coming, so that warning is going to catch you off guard. Now, these are called proactive cues. So I am proactively telling you something's going to happen, or reactive, where it just happens and you have to react.
Okay.
I'd say 99% of all inhibition studies focus on proactive cueing.
I see.
Because it's easy and it's understandable and it's a nice control. But we don't really know, does the same mechanics explain and control how you do it in the real world on the fly when you're not given a warning? And it isn't at all hard to see why. If we have all this data and we only understand how to do it artificially, where I give you a warning that you'd never see in the real world, our ability to explain how you're processing information with this inhibition and regulatory systems gets really limited real fast for the real world. So I read some papers when I was starting my PhD, like really at the start, by somebody called Sao Seng and by Marlies Fiziers, who then I actually got to have a chat with. I actually realized she was visiting the university as I was reading these papers. And I went over her work and I effectively had a question about her work, which was, why does nobody try and make it that the studies are completely unpredictable? Why did it? Because technically our study is unpredictable, but then we had a cue that tells you what's going to happen, so it's predictable. Why does nobody make it that the cues are effectively lies? That you have truthful data, you have truthful cues that are helping you, and then alongside that you have untruthful cues, cues that are uninformative, that are ones you need to ignore, but you don't know which ones they are, and that's getting a lot closer to real life. So we designed this study, which was really simple. All it did was just present letters to you. You just had to press a letter when you saw a vowel, sorry, press a key when you saw a vowel. We made it as simple as we could, but sometimes the instructions you were given were lies. You would be told, don't worry, there's only going to be visual, just chill. And then we'd play auditory sounds and mess with them. And it was great fun. And we wanted to try and look at how could we put the same statistical models, which I won't go too much into, but we have statistical methods for understanding how somebody is inhibiting parts of their brain. Do the ones that we use when we give you proper warnings match when we create a scenario that is closer but still not very close to the real world? Now, if you're not trained in science, what you kind of expect there is, okay, well, if they match, you've succeeded. And if you fail, you've got it wrong. That's actually, there's a way you need to think about it, is the changes. It doesn't matter what our result is. As soon as we know, that's more information. And the more information we have, the better we can understand how the brain works. Maybe there are two different mechanisms for when you get a good warning, or you get a warning that you know you can't trust, or a warning you're not sure you can trust. If that one uses alpha, like I said earlier, and one uses another band, there's actually some suspicion that it belongs to theta, which is an even slower band. Cool, we don't care. That's more data, that's more information that we get to use. We have no stake in what the answer is, we just want to know what it is.
Okay, so were you always interested in science growing up?
Yes, massively. I loved science as a kid. I particularly like that you can look at something that is so complicated and actually understand how it works. That's fascinating to me, that you can look at something as complicated as an electrical board or a wire, which by Arthur C. Clarke's, the science fiction writer's third law, effectively is magic to parts of our history as a civilization, and you can understand it and it can make sense. That's great. And the brain is just even more complicated than that.
So what got you interested in psychology to begin with?
That's actually because I'm autistic and I don't understand people very well. I find people very frustrating and very aggravating, as most people with, particularly Asperger's, or whatever it's called at the moment. There is a discussion, if you're interested, to look if Asperger's is a real condition. I'm definitely on the autistic spectrum, whatever you want to call it, is up for debate. When I was a teenager, I found the illogical nature of people really, really distressing. So I studied psychology to be able to understand people, and found it very interesting that people follow consistent rules, that even in our most irrational, confusing moments, there is still a pattern to our behavior. And neuroscience offered even more interesting questions about not having to really talk or trust the person and have any of those issues that they might not understand, they might not want to tell you the truth. You can just look at the brain data and start to understand a lot more about how the person is thinking.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. And I know the feeling sometimes if you're like, people act irrationally or illogically. I think as someone who is a science communicator who constantly interacts with other science journalists and YouTubers and people who actually do this for a living. I think you may think someone is acting illogically, but a lot of what they do also comes, and I guess this is where the psychology comes in, it also comes with your belief system, your belief structure. So a lot of those investments mentally come into play with how you behave. I don't know if that makes sense to psychologists.
Yeah, it does.
So
yeah, one of the things that I really learned as a psychologist is you can't, as a scientist, you can't have emotion about what you're looking at. Your emotions are clouding your judgment. So even if you're looking at a system that makes sense, but it makes a horrible kind of sense, or it makes a sense that you know somebody is going to let you down or even betray you, in normal society, you are told to ignore that. You are told to take what the person says at face value, even if you have evidence to believe that they might not be trustworthy, and just hope for the best. And as I grew up as a teenager, that was a really upsetting thing to have to just kind of be told, yeah, this probably is going to screw you over, but, you know, smile and bear it and just accept it. And that's like being asked to put your hand to a hot fire and keep smiling. It's a really unpleasant feeling. As a psychologist, when you're told, okay, look at this system and does it make sense? Like, yes. What's the output? Something really horrible. Okay. But does it make sense? Like, yes. That clicked for me. I was able to understand systems in a way that you don't get upset at the... If you look at people and they're doing things you don't like, well, as long as it's part of the system, it doesn't really matter if you like it or not. It's the science. So that became a lot more accessible and a lot more agreeable to me on a personal level. You can end up looking at things like social psychology and how groups ostracize and hurt each other. You don't really feel worried about it, but all you need to do is just say, yeah, it makes sense. It follows. Those are the rules. It's predictable. We have a good understanding of why the mechanics are working, move on. And that's kind of how I ended up becoming a psychologist. And it informs a lot about how I kind of live as a person too.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So I guess we've covered like a lot of subjects from both your psychology side as well as your neuroscience side. So is there anything you'd like to say as we start wrapping up that I may have gotten wrong or that you didn't get a chance to say?
So the only thing is that we didn't get to cover my last experiment, but for the sake of time, I'll simply say, keep an eye on my work. It will get published later on and you will hopefully be able to see. If it is only presented in inaccessible forms for the scientific community, I will try and find a way to make it more accessible for the general audience, because it is definitely the most complex study I've ever done. And I'll try and find ways to make it people agreeable rather than the robots to pretend they're neuroscientists agreeable.
So final two things.
But final notes. I would say,
why don't you tell us a little bit about what your plans are when you finish your PhD?
I prefer not to because I have no clue what they are.
Oh well.
COVID's COVID's kind of thrown that up in the air. Nobody really knows, so I can't really say. And on occasion, trying to plan for an unknown is just too stressful. It doesn't get you anywhere. As soon as the system restabilizes, you have to replan, and you kind of just stress yourself out for no purpose. But I would say, if anybody is ever curious about understanding psychology, it is definitely a region that I suggest quite a few people look into. Understanding how the people around you think and act and are in a scientific manner can show a lot more to you than you might want to accept. There is a lot of information about how people work and how people are. I also know a lot of that information is not used regularly by people because it's upsetting or inconvenient. But it can be fascinating if you're willing to have a look.
Yeah, makes sense. If anyone wants to get in touch with you to ask you questions about what you do or your research, or is doing neuroscience the right thing for them or anything, well, how can they contact you?
They can contact me. I have a LinkedIn, which is professionally about me as a neuroscientist. That's just Wilf Nelson, WILF. I will send over David a photo of myself so you can post it and you know what I look like, but not many people have my name. And there is a Twitter account which is related to some other stuff I do, but we'll get to that later on in the episode, or the next episode, depending on how this is cut.
Yeah, I'll be sure to leave like your personal links in the show notes. And it was nice having you on.
It was nice being on. I don't regularly get to talk about my research that much.
Well, I hope you had fun talking about it. And I'll probably have to like listen to this all over again. And I'll probably learn something. Actually, I'll actually stick this time. So I hope you enjoyed my talk with Wolf. And will join us for the second episode when we talk about his podcast, Water Cooler Neuroscience. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, or even leave a comment wherever you listen to this episode. Anything you do goes a long way to supporting this channel, and I look forward to having you join us for the next episode when I talk to another science communicator.